Hey, folks, and welcome to Typology, the show on which we explore the mystery of the human personality through the lens of the Enneagram. My name is Anthony Skinner, your producer and co-host. So happy to have you here, folks. We've got a great guest today talking about Mary Atkins, an Enneagram 3 Wing 2. She's an author, writing coach, and founder of The Book Incubator, which is a 12-month program to help people write, revise, and pitch novels and memoirs. Really, really cool. She's a graduate of Yale Law School and Duke University. She also has a podcast that you should check out called the First Draft Club podcast, and it's all about helping people write. So today we talk about each Enneagram type, and it's not specific to writing, which of course she is a writing coach and her company, The Book Incubator, is obviously working with writers, but really it's anyone in the creative process. So, and we're all creating. Whether you're in business, whether you're cooking a meal, whether you're a songwriter or a book writer, or you're a content creator, on some level, we're all creating throughout the day. And so we go through each Enneagram type and what you might be up against and what you have in your backpack that could help you out. So glad that you're here. That's it for me, Anthony Skinner. And now, without any further ado, here is the host of our show, Ian Cron.
Hello, Typology friends. Happy New Year from me, Ian Morgan Cron, your host here on the show, where we talk about the mystery of the human personality and the human adventure through the lens of the Enneagram. I am, of course, as always, joined by my confrere, my dearest pal of all time. Happy New Year, Anthony Skinner.
Happy New Year, Ian Cron. How are you, man?
You know what, man? I am...
Well, let me just say this. Can I back up and say this? I know you're really happy that you have had all of your family come and join you there in San Miguel, right? And I'm sure you're happy that they are already gone, like before New Year's, right? I mean, it was probably good to have them there for a little window. And
okay, let me make some things clear to you.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's the first thing I want to make clear to you. They left yesterday.
No way.
Okay. No. When my kids come to town, they set up a tent city. I am not kidding you. It was something. So I had 8 people in my house for 2 weeks.
What?
And yes, 2 dogs, 8 people, and I was telling some of my recovery friends this afternoon in a meeting that it is possible that a sweet little casita in San Miguel de Allende can transform itself into a gulag when you have 8 adult children in it for 15 days.
I bet.
That's all I got to say. And by the way,
were you begging for solitary confinement by the end of this, or?
I was like, put me in the hole. Okay? That's what I'm talking about. And, of course, you know, like right now, I literally have 5 pages left of a book to write. Mm. 5 or 6 pages left. And our guest right now is going to help me because for the last 2 weeks, I have been struggling to finish those last 5 pages. And, oh, dude.
This you is know perfect this timing.
Oh, no, it is so perfect. Now, you know this as a songwriter, mm-hmm. right? It's like when you get down to like the last 5 pages and you've been working day in and day out for months, it's like, you know those YouTube videos where you watch the person running, they're like in a marathon and they're running for they can see the tape. They're about to run through the tape and their legs turn to rubber.
The cramps and the dehydration kicks in like 100 yards away.
I need our guest to carry me. Now they pick, like some nice guy picks them up and carries them over the line.
Oh, man.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to introduce you to our guest today. It is Mary Atkins, Enneagram 3 with a 2 wing. She is a writing coach, founder of The Book Incubator. We're going to learn all about that. It's this cool 12-month program where you write, revise, and pitch a novel or a memoir. We got so much to talk about that's going to be applicable to everybody. Mary Atkins, save my life. Welcome to the show.
So glad to come in on that note.
Golly whiz. It was sort of like a manic episode just to listen to myself talk like that. Anyway.
Well, let me just say that what we talked about before we got started here today is – Mary, you do help people with books, but really the creative process this translates to anyone that's doing anything, really, I would think, on some level. So this is going to be something good for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we can. I think we can talk about creating in general, just the creativity and the Enneagram, I think, is a really interesting intersection.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. It really is. And now, your sister is an Enneagram coach. You have been steeped in it like a teabag for quite some time. But interestingly, for a long time, you thought you were a seven, right? The enthusiast. In reality, you're a performer, or the achiever, as some call it. What was the journey like of discovering your type?
Well, interestingly, I always tested as a seven. You know, I would take the test. I loved doing the testing for fun, the longer ones, the shorter ones, the paid ones, the unpaid ones. And I would always test as a seven, with a three close behind. Mm. But I just, you know, I would read the description of the seven. I would think like, yeah, that sounds like me. I like to have fun. I get bored easily. I don't like to feel trapped. You know, it felt like it resonated. And actually, it wasn't until I ended up working with a friend on a project, and she's an Enneagram coach. Now, she wasn't Enneagram coaching me, but she is an Enneagram coach. And she's like, I don't think you're a seven. And it was like, it was like blasphemy. It just didn't, I thought, what do you mean I'm not a seven? She's like, I think you're a three. And when she said it, I was like, no, like I didn't think it was cool to be a three. I thought it was cool to be a seven. Mm. Like sevens are the life of the party. You know, it was like, oh, I'm a seven. I'm fun. But she said, you know, and she started to kind of lay out her case, which was, and as she did, I started to see like, oh yeah. Cause she knew me pretty well at this point and knew that like persona is something that I started cultivating really young, mm-hmm. like wanting people to see me a particular way. It's something I've really had to try to unpack as an adult, like separate my authentic self from my persona. Valuing myself for my productivity and work was just so inherent that it was like unquestioned. Like it was just, my value is what I'm producing, period. Mm. Like that is who I am. And then really, you know, I think the thing she said that was the most striking to me, she's like, you know how you told me if you're in a room with people and you have an opinion that they don't share, you hide it because you don't want to be disagreeable or for people to like think something of you that whatever you may not like. And she's like, sevens don't really do that. Like that's like a three. That's like a three thing. Mm. And we talked about a mutual friend of ours who's a seven. She's like, you know how she is? And I was like, oh yeah, she really just kind of says what she thinks. And I'm not a person who just kind of says what I think. I mean, I've historically been very curated in what I present and how I present it. And like consciously so, like as a child, I remember doing that, like being like, who will I be? Let me design that person. Mm. So that was really that was the shift for me, is realizing like, okay, I'm a three. And I think a lot of I think one reason I didn't identify as a three at first is it seemed like a lot of the description of the three was more statusy in a way that I didn't identify with. Like, it's not necessarily, or it isn't actually status that I feel like I've wanted, but it is approval, you know, like it is creating a persona that people would like and admire was always important to me. But not necessarily like, in a hierarchical way, mm-hmm. you know, which I think misled me. Cause I thought, well, if I'm a three, then I just want people to like, I just want to be impressive at all costs. For example, I was a lawyer before. And I think I thought, well, if I were a three, I would have just stayed in law because law is prestigious, but you know, it's more nuanced than that, I guess.
It definitely is. And I think a lot of times people only go down the wormhole of the Enneagram just far enough that they can sort of kind of describe the nine different types and stuff. But they really, the Enneagram is easy to learn. It's hard to master. And so the further you go in, the more you realize this is super nuanced.
Yeah.
Super nuanced. And it, when you're really working with it, you have to have a kind of humility. I mean, I've been working with the Enneagram for quite some time now, and I'm amazed at oftentimes what I don't know. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so yeah. I think you have to, about other people and about how they present. And because man, you're talking about someone's inner architecture. It's not on the outside. And so yeah. that's what makes it wonderful and at times frustrating because, you know, it's there's no blood test to be taken to figure out your type. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so you have to have humility and patience and an openness to being wrong about yourself and about others, you know, mm-hmm. And just to stay curious as you help people and yourself on the journey towards identifying type and your patterns, et cetera, et cetera. So I totally get that. So you mentioned that, you know, you've this whole idea of curating a persona, right? Sometimes I've heard threes use the word landscaping them, like they landscape themselves, right?
Oh my gosh, I love that. Yeah.
So how have you worked with it? Like you know, like in your own life, as you think about personal, emotional, spiritual, psychological growth, how have you worked with it?
I mean, the hardest work I've done and the most work I've done has been around not conflating my self-value with work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been very recent work I've done just in the last 2 years. And it really, for me, honestly, and I think I've heard it said that with threes, a lot of times, I think it might've been a friend who said this, but with threes, a lot of times it's the body that sort of brings them face to face with their issues or their work to be done. And that was the case with me. I faced infertility. I have a son, but I faced secondary infertility, which is when you can't have a subsequent child. And the inability to control my body and make it have a baby, like no matter how hard I worked or how much I did, was really what like turned my whole way of living upside down, because I had basically, I mean, being a three was working really well for me. And so I thought, you know, it was like, I work hard at something, it works out. I work hard at something, it works out. Like if I just put my mind to it and just don't give up, I'll get what I want. And then suddenly it was like, this is the thing I want the most and it's not working. Like that isn't working here. So how do I reconcile those things? And then it was starting to face like, wait, maybe it's never been true that my hard work is what makes everything good happen. Maybe I just thought it was. And maybe like hard work isn't what gives me value as a person, which still is like a very hard idea for me to get my head around. But so it was, yeah, it was like it was a insurmountable kind of life obstacle that led me to even see the Enneagram as something that could help me change how I live, really.
Mm-hmm.
And until then, and this is, by the way, when I realized I was a three around the same time, because until then it was just kind of like a fun personality discussion topic. You know, it's like, I'm a seven. What are you?
Right.
And then it became like, wait, this is like the core of who I am and how do I want to be a person?
This is the core of who I am and how do I want to be a person? Is that what you just said?
Mm-hmm.
I love that. What a wonderful question. Like, how do I want to show up for life? How do I want to be in this world? Those are lovely, big, ultimate life kinds of queries that, you know, are like super, super, super important. And it's lovely when I hear people asking those kinds of questions of depth, you know? Hey, Anthony, you know how you throw a dryer sheet into the dryer when doing your laundry?
Mm-hmm.
Like, have you ever wondered why we can't do that in the washing machine?
Exactly. Why do I have to use liquid detergent that comes in a big, heavy plastic container that always drips onto my washer and then gets tossed into the garbage? I know that takes years to break down.
Right. Well, fortunately, I have found a solution.
Ooh.
Earth Breeze. Have you heard of this yet?
I have not.
Well, let me tell you about Earth Breeze. Picture something that looks like a dryer sheet, but it actually replaces that cup of like blue goo. It's a pre-measured liquidless laundry detergent sheet.
What?
Yeah, that dissolves in all wash cycles, whether it's hot or cold, man. So no measuring, no mess, no heavy lifting. That's right.
No plastic jug.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Tell me more.
All right. Well, it comes in a cardboard envelope that saves a ton of space and it's recyclable. Each package comes with 30 sheets that can wash up to 60 loads of laundry. I signed up for their subscription, okay? And I love that it's delivered with free carbon offset shipping right when I need it. And I have full control to adjust, pause, or cancel that subscription without hidden fees or penalties. Most importantly, I still get a powerful, clean load of laundry from my Earth Breeze. I'm telling you, it's tough on stains, fights odors, and my clothes come out clean every time. Now, when I do the laundry, I just quickly throw in a sheet and I feel good about doing something positive for the environment.
Ooh, Anthony. I love this. So what if I try it and I don't like it?
Well, guess what? They offer 100% satisfaction guarantee. If you don't like it, you'll get a full refund, no questions asked, and no return necessary.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Trust me, there is no reason not to switch. Right now, our listeners can subscribe to EarthBreeze and save 40%. So go to earthbreeze.com/typologypodcast to get started. That's earthbreeze.com/typologypodcast for 40% off. earthbreeze.com/typologypodcast. Speaking about the body, because I think this might be helpful for one of the subtypes of threes, right? The sexual subtype. Mm-hmm. Do you know what your subtype is?
I don't know enough about the subtypes.
Okay.
I mean, I know what they are, but I don't know enough to have kind of self-diagnosed mine.
Yeah. So there's one subtype of the three called the sexual three, or sometimes it's called the one-to-one three. And they are not as – so if you were a social three, that's the iconic three, right? Like, mm-hmm. Sounds like – kind of sounds like that's what you are as you describe, but I don't know enough yet. Okay. And then there's a self-pres three, but don't talk about that. Sexual three, their image and persona is all around presenting as the ideal male or female person. And so it's all about body and appearance, clothing, looks, but it's about embodying the ideal man, the ideal woman, right? Like in however that person defines that, right?
Yeah.
And so like I know a guy, and Anthony, you know this person too, but they were in the publishing business and they are a sexual three, and they were very concerned about working out. This guy had to look great. Mm. He was very handsome. Haircut had to be perfect. Clothes had to be, wore very clothes that cost more than he made. You know what I mean? But very concerned about being the iconic ideal male persona, right? Like, and they have there was a kind of flirty dimension to this type of three. But guess what? They get older. And their bodies start to, now I don't want to say betray them, because that's an unfair way to think of your body as an enemy, but it's more like that's when the work started for this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Was when, guess what? Your clothes don't fit like they used to, and you have a lot of wrinkles now, and the plastic surgery is not working as much as it used to. Stuff's starting to sag, bro. And so it's like, again, I love this idea that the body starts to kind of dictate the work.
Yeah. I really like that too. And I do think it's funny, because before you said, and then you get older, I was already thinking, I think I was a sexual three in my youth and even as a child, I remember as a child deciding I was going to be Miss America because she was like the embodiment of like the perfect woman.
Wow.
I remember deciding that as a child, I will be Miss America because she's perfect. Like that's perfect.
Yeah.
But then in adulthood, I don't think that shifted, I think.
Yeah. So that would be something for you to explore on your own, right? Like just checking out the subtypes, because the subtypes, like they drop another lens, like you get at the doctor's office, you're having your eyes checked and they go, is this clearer? It's like, you go, that's even like clearer about. So you just get more honed insights, into your particular kind of three, that is really helpful. All right. You run this amazing thing. You're a writing coach. I don't even know how you got into that. You went to Yale Law School, you went to Duke, and now you're a writing coach. How you made that jump, I have no idea. But you are, And you're founder of the Book Incubator, which is this 12-month program that helps, I guess, aspiring writers to write and revise and pitch their novels or their memoirs to publishers or to agents, I guess. Let's talk about, because this is like your jam, let's talk about like how the Enneagram intersects with creativity and like what are the challenges and the strengths that each type brings, not just to a writing project, though, trust me, I'd love to talk about through that lens, but if they were a musician, if they're a painter, if they're a sculptor, or if they're just a creative and they're just, you know, going at trying to create something new. Because I think every type would love to know, like, what are my strengths? What's my challenges? And then what's the solution
you know,
to some of those things? That sound like a plan?
Yeah, that sounds great. And just so listeners know, they're not just like, here's a lawyer talking to me about creativity. I did leave law and then write three novels. So my career really over the past 11 years since I left law has been writing fiction.
Right.
And so this program, I primarily work with people, right? Well, the program is just for people working on writing novels and memoirs. But I do think the conversation about Enneagram creativity can apply to other fields as well. And I bring up the Enneagram a lot in my coaching because once I discovered it for myself, it was like, oh my gosh, this is so incredibly rich and helpful for people understanding their own motivation and their own obstacles. Because so much of getting a book done, as you were just saying, is like motivation based. I mean, so much, it's like 99% motivation and like 1% anything else. So yeah. So it's so illuminating to introduce it. And I kind of see my role, since I'm not an Enneagram expert, I'm just kind of an Enneagram nerd. Like, I see my role in this aspect as introducing people to it, kind of giving them my experience, helping them like do just some basic navigation around what number they might be, and then giving them resources to research on their own. But we do talk about like, okay, for your type, what might be some things that come up and what might be some ways of getting around those challenges.
Yeah. Oh man, this is going to be rich. So by the way, Mary, just so you know, nothing motivates me more than a cashed advance check. There's nothing.
It's very motivating.
Agreed. Cashed advance checks and a deadline. And being an ex-Catholic little boy that is terrified of a nun who's going to like hit me with a ruler for getting it in late. Anyway, so all right, let's talk about Enneagram ones, right? The improvers. Like, as they go into writing a novel, writing a memoir, or any other creative endeavor, strengths, challenges, what happens in your experience for ones?
So I feel like with ones, and this is gonna be real basic, but because it's just, you know, I have now worked with a number of writers, a few dozen on this, where I've like figured out their number and we've kind of but it's still a pretty small sample size. But I will say for ones, I feel like a common issue can be being willing to make a mess, and you kind of have to make a mess in the first draft because it's the first draft. And like, I get it too. Like, I'm not a one and I still struggle with making a mess in the first draft because you kind of, I don't know, maybe it's just human instinct to want it to want to be efficient and want it to be great. You know, it's like, I'm going to be the first person who writes a really great first draft the first time around. That's going to be me. And then I won't have to spend a bunch of time fixing it. But like, no one is that person. And Stephen King is not that person. And I don't feel like that person exists. So, and I think it helps me in terms of being like mess making in the first draft to really trust that like by making a mess, you discover those great gems, like the sparkling gems. And those are what's going to make it really good in the end anyway. Like no book, sometimes I'll tell myself and others, like a great book isn't great because the whole thing's great. It's great because there are like three or four really great parts and the rest is like tolerable.
Right.
So, right? Like The Great Gatsby, it's like people love the ending. Like that's the really good part.
Yes.
And the rest is fine.
Yes.
You know?
Yep.
So like, I feel like it can be pressure relieving for someone like a one, because if they go in thinking the whole thing needs to be perfect, like that's really paralyzing.
Exactly. And you know, it's interesting, right? Like, as I mentioned, I'm just now about five or six pages away from finishing up the first draft of this book. It's my fifth book. And this is the first time I've ever allowed myself to write, as Anne Lamott calls it in Bird by Bird, the shitty first draft.
Oh, the first time you have?
Really, like where I gave myself complete and utter permission to just vomit up stuff, right?
Yeah.
And I've had more fun writing this book than any other book I've ever written. I'm not saying it's going to be the best book I've ever written. All I'm going to say is I've had the most fun. Which,
yeah.
And because this is what ones do, I think. Number one, they oftentimes get stuck on the first page because it's like they feel like they've got to come up with a line like, my name is Ishmael, out the gate. Right?
Yes.
Like right out the gate.
Right.
And it's like, no, that probably came in a lot later. Yeah. And
that was the last line he wrote. Probably.
That's right. That was the last line he wrote. And so if we have two sides to the brain, right? We have the creative side and then we have the editor. Right. Mm-hmm. So, and you can't have both online at the same time. And if you're editing while you're writing, the two sides of your hemispheres of your brain are having one is prosecuting your lousy writing and chasing away the little creative. And it's like, you got to just say to the editor, because I actually love editing, you got to say, look, you know what? I can't wait to turn this manuscript over to you.
Yes.
But really right now, you just got to let me play.
Yeah.
And that can be hard for ones.
Really hard. I feel like hard for everybody and especially hard for ones, because it's also, sometimes I'll say the same thing and the editor, sometimes I'll say like the editor, it's not their job yet, but also they don't even have anything to work with yet. Like they have no material with which to do their job because their job is to edit. And you can't, like you said, you can't edit as you write. Like that's like trying to build a boat while you're riding the boat. Like you can't do it. So like they'll get their moment. It's just not yet. Like there's nothing to hand to them yet.
So where a one needs to live, if they can, is at the high side of seven in their security point, where it's just have fun, man. Like let your hair down, give yourself a margarita and start writing. Cause it's just like, just let yourself go. Yeah. And you know what? Like I'll tell you something, Mary, like, all right, so I have a faith-based publisher, but I got a potty mouth. And so I will tell you this, all through this manuscript, there is all kinds of like where I got excited and I started throwing language around that I know will never make it into the book, right?
Yeah.
Like it is going to get taken right. But it was just like, woohoo, I'm just going to keep writing, you know, and I'll find another more faith-friendly word when I get to this again, go back around the second time. But I think for that one, to give themselves permission to play, and just also trust the process. Very hard on your first book to trust a process you've never been through. But, you know, that there's going to be an opportunity to come back and you know, polish the teeth after you've, you know, cleaned them. You know, anyway, so that is true, by the way, everybody, of ones in any creative endeavor. What we just described is a challenge for that one. Mm-hmm. Now, the strength is they're so conscientious.
Yeah.
They will sit down and work. They will set the clock. They will put the time in. It's like it's maybe one of the, maybe it arguably the most conscientious number. And that you need that self-discipline to be a good writer or a good musician or a good business person, whatever it is, or entrepreneur. You gotta have the sit in the chair thing.
Yeah. And you know, we can go in order, but I will say that I think that in my experience, threes and eights also, like if when they kind of join my program, when they join my program and commit to writing a book, like they finish it. Mm-hmm. Like they're like, they just do it for, you know, I haven't met one who hasn't. Other types, maybe we have to, there has to be cajoling, more just like, I'm not sure if I'm going to get there. But in terms of the, like putting your butt in the chair and getting it done. So,
yeah. Okay. That's good. I can see that. It's interesting because we have so many authors on the show. I'm always, you know, we have a ton of threes and eights, right? And sometimes I have to tell our publicist and our booker and everybody else that you got to give me something to work with here. Like I need a six, I need a five,
you know,
because threes and eights are out there. They finish stuff and they're really good.
And they're hustling.
They're hustling it. They're out there hustling. Yeah, that's for sure. Okay. Let's talk about twos for a second. The helpers, like what are some of the challenges and strengths they have as they're getting engaged in the creative process?
So I find So I work really closely with the two. She works, she's kind of my, one of my right-hand gals in the program. And she's a novelist, but she has three kids. And so she's momming and working and writing her novel. And so a struggle for her has always been like carving out that time for herself. Because when you don't have when you don't have the book deal and the advance check, it can feel selfish to do it. Especially for someone like a two, where it's like, oh, but it's not for others. And I'm a parent and I'm trying to. So something that actually worked really well for her, and she tells the story, is like, she would write by hand in a notebook. She wrote her first novel in carpool line, like in her van, because it was time she had to be killing anyway. And she got the whole novel done that way. Wow. And then she didn't have to like fight to justify it in her head. She's like, I'm just sitting here. And she got a book deal, and like that's, and so it's coming out this year.
Wow.
But yeah, she just wrote it in carpool line. So I think, you know, I don't know if this is too specific advice, like specific advice to twos, but that story to me demonstrates like the importance of flexibility. Like writing doesn't have to mean sitting at a computer and typing mm-hmm. while you're in an office. You know, it could be dictating into your phone when you're in the car. I mean, it can look like all kinds of different things.
Yes.
She wrote the whole book that way. So.
Yes. So I think with twos and nines, oftentimes what happens is they do feel like self-investment, but this is for two very different reasons. Okay. Mm-hmm. It presents the same way for two different reasons. They do think that self-investment is selfish. And so, you know, right. And they also, like in the case of a nine, would say that this project is secondary in importance to my wife's project or my husband's project or my children's projects or this, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So that's a struggle, I think, for twos and nines for different reasons, you know?
Yeah.
So one of the things I would imagine for twos that is so helpful and painful at the same time is learning how to create in a space where they're by themselves and there's no mm-hmm. relational energy in the atmosphere.
Oh, that's really interesting.
You know, I think it's like, I know lots of twos who on the beginning of the journey of self-discovery and doing their own personal work, the idea, like, you know, they would say, okay, I'm going on a personal, silent personal retreat. And it's like, really? Wow, that's going to be something. And because then they derive so much of their identity from relationships that if there are no relationships around, they start to feel empty and lost.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And writing is so solitary.
It is
Something as long as a book, especially. Mm. I know we're not just talking about writing, but.
Yeah, it's really solitary. And now, that said, I wrote, my first book was a novel. In that book, I wrote with literally with a kid on my lap half the time. You know what I mean? Like they were little kids and I'm like, right. You know? And so I actually like a little bit of energy around like people, but I don't want them to talk to me. I just like, so sometimes the coffee shop can be okay,
but
I don't want you to talk to me. I just want to know there's other humans around and I can look up every now and then. But I think with twos, man, that time alone is hard, but it's so important to do their own work. It's like, really, really key. And I would imagine though with writing novels, you know, they're so attuned to the feelings of others. And I think this is true with songwriters too, Anthony. They're so attuned to the feelings of others that they can do some really, really good work at sort of probing the heart, you know?
Agreed.
Okay, I'm just going to betray something. There's one thing I hate in writing. Well, there's lots of different things in writing that I don't like when I read. And one of them is sentimentalism. I cannot take sentimentalism. I just, the moment I smell it, I just go, oh, this is awful. It's just cheap. And of all the types, sometimes twos can be the most sentimental. They got to be careful.
That's interesting. Yeah.
You know?
I can see that.
So anyway, all right. So twos, if you're listening, if you're a painter, if you're a writer, if you're an artist, if you're an entrepreneur, anything that's creative, right? Hopefully some of the things that we've said will be like really helpful to you. And one of them is be flexible. Another one is, you know, discipline yourself to maybe spending some time alone where you're not distracted in an atmosphere where you're tempted to go toward relationships instead of the work in front of you. Great. Threes, you know about this.
Threes, I know about this. Yes. So threes, we're so persona focused that I think it can be really interesting to do some exercises where you Well, you could imagine some fantasy situations. So one, you write this and no one ever reads it. You don't try to get it published. Just like, what does it feel like to imagine that? Just like try it on. And another one is, so I had this interesting experience with my editor. I had published a couple novels with her. She was my editor. And we were discussing my next one. And she said, well, what if you do like a big epic, like multi-generational, just like a big, you know, big story, like whopper of a story. And I was talking with my husband about it later that day. And I was like, I can't do that though. I don't think I can do that. It just doesn't feel like something I'm capable of. And he asked the most, he's an 8, by the way. And he asked the most interesting question. He's like, what if someone had hired you to ghostwrite it? Could you do it? And my just reflexive answer was like, yeah. Like if my name weren't on it, I could do it. And he was like, so that's kind of telling, right? Like, you think if it were, you were doing it for someone else anonymously, you could do it. But like, if it's by Mary Atkins, you're like, no, I don't think I can. And that was, I was just like a very illuminating moment for me because it made me like realize how much my whole, like, even if it's kind of subconscious or buried pretty low, like what people are going to think of me when this thing is read is at play, even as I'm doing it. Yeah.
It's so good. Mm-hmm. That is so good. I've written down this question for 3s. You know, like, how would you write this book or start this company or do this painting, whatever, if no one else was ever going to read or see it?
Yeah.
Where you wouldn't have to worry about your persona or how you came off or anything else.
Right.
Just, you're just writing it for the pure love. Now, a 3 might begin by saying, I just wouldn't do it then. If no one else was going to read it and admire it, why would I do it?
So maybe then they could ask themselves, okay, well, what if they were going to read it, but they would never know you read it? You would not be associated with
good.
It.
That's really, really
like it,
good.
Like it I could have that. A really big impact, but you wouldn't be.
Yeah. I think that's fun.
I mean, that's like writing an anonymous check. That's like writing an anonymous check for your church.
Yeah.
Do I really want to make it anonymous? You know.
That's a good one right there.
All right. Now, 4s, I bet you have some trouble working with 4s. I bet, I just know you do. Come on, Mary, tell me the truth.
Yes. Oh my gosh, 4s are so hard on themselves. I know we all have imposter syndrome and insecurity around our writing. I feel like 4s, the 4s I work with have the most, you know, where it will be like, I don't know, I feel like 4s in my experience will often be the ones to be like, I'm talentless, like go to kind of an extreme, like I'm talentless. This is pointless. Why am I even doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Like it gets existential really fast.
Oh yeah.
And that's why I was laughing because I do find that challenging. I'm like, we went really far down really fast. It's not like, oh, how do I, you know, write these next 20 pages? It's like, why am I even bothering?
Yeah. Yep.
So if you have thoughts, I welcome those.
Well, I mean, look, I'm a 4, but I'm a self-pressed 4. So I actually am a little bit more like a 3 or a 7 at times. And so my 3 wing really takes over when I'm writing. I'm pretty ambitious and I'm actually quite conscientious when I'm in a healthy place. I get up every single day and I write for hours. I mean, whether I want to or not, you know, like it's like, we'll sit down and get to work, right? Now, that said, I do, as a younger man, this what you're describing was far more true of me. But, you know, heck, I'm 63 and I've done a lot of personal work and whatnot. So I'm not as shackled to that kind of thinking anymore. But it is true that 4s, they're melodramatic. And everything is personal and everything is a commentary on them in their own mind. And because of that, they can become their own. And this is why, by the way, 4s, oftentimes, they have such incredible, rich imaginations. They are like
crazy. Yes, I was about to say that. They're so imaginative.
Oh, you can't beat them. You cannot beat
them. Which is why it's ironic that they're like, what's the point? It's not original. And you're like, it's so original.
Exactly.
It's so unique and good.
Yes, yeah. So sometimes when I get into that space, and this is where I get stuck. I'm writing a book and I think, this just doesn't sound authentic. This doesn't sound like the real me. And I start going down that existential hole, right? And then finally, and then, you know, then there's the self-flagellation and I suck and blah, blah, blah. And then my wife, God bless her, she'll say, I'll be saying this stuff aloud. She'll be like, don't flatter yourself. Don't flatter yourself. There are lots of crappier people than you. And it's true, right? So there, I think fours, you know, it's like you sort of have to say to them, you know, okay, that's all very nice and good. I'm glad that you're channeling your inner Kurt Cobain, but we really don't have time for that right now. What we're going to really try to do is work on structure and form, and right, just, you know, it's yeah. like kind of redirect. And God, I wish some fours had more of a sense of humor about their own creative process and about their inner world, but it could take decades of work to get to that.
And there's a similar sort of paralysis, I think, that the four experiences, it can look like the one
yes.
where it's not perfection, but it's idealizing. Mm.
Yes.
You're such idealist. Yes. It's like you, and so if it's not the ideal first line, I can't even start, you know, it's gotta be just,
yeah.
which there is no ideal. So just get to write it.
Totally. But then I guess on the upside of this, like I find too that fours did, but then they'll snap out of it. Like it doesn't last often.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Fours who, or like any type, you begin to step back and self-observe and go, oh, there we go. I'm doing that. Mm-hmm. I'm doing that thing again. Or as a three, you might say, oh, I'm like telling a story in this memoir that's not exactly true, but it sure makes me look good. So I'm going to put it in there. You know what I mean? And then you step back and you go, look at what I'm doing, right? So
yeah,
if you can get on board with knowing your own type and seeing where it's falling apart in the creative process, it's like it saves you a lot of time.
Totally. And I was just looking at some of the mantras I had written down for different types for the people in my program. And for four, I had written down structure is good because I think when they have the structure, it helps them be like, okay, I know I'm going to feel these like roller coaster of emotions, but like, this is what I've decided. So I'm sticking to this.
Oh, there's a story I tell when I'm working with creatives and you deal with this with the fours, and it's when Jodie Foster was making the movie Taxi with De Niro, and she'd already, you know, heard about and experienced how De Niro's, what's the word when you're...
Method acting?
No, not method acting, but when you're acting and it's like kind of off the cuff.
Improvising?
Improv, yeah. So she was already connected to his improv and how he worked with Scorsese in that way and how they were really rich in that. So she was all excited on day one. And when she got there, she experienced him. He knew all the lines. He knew her lines, yeah. all of his lines, so much so that he could step out and improv, but step back in and serve the actor, you know, not to like stress her out, but to champion her as well.
Wow.
And so she realized the power of structure, you know, in that moment.
Cool.
And I thought that was really cool. Yeah.
That is really
That's
cool.
Really
How it
cool.
actually elevates you. It doesn't, for the yeah. four, it can feel constrictive, but if you actually realize the power in it, it can be a launching pad, you know?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, the four's difficulty as a creative sometimes is this. They get so up in the imagination. There are so many ideas, so many excellent ideas, but so much self-doubt that there's little execution. And so when you find, that's why they have to go to the high side of one when they're doing a creative endeavor, because there they get conscientious, structured, like they just, critical thinking goes online instead of just, you know, their sort of normal pattern of feeling too much, you know?
Yep.
All right. Well, this is all so good. Let's talk about four some more. No, let's move on to fives. You got some fives?
I do have some fives. And I think the key for fives I've found, just basic tip, is that they have to separate research and writing. And also they need to know that they can do, sometimes I'll call it minimum viable research for a first draft. Mm. So like for a first draft, you have to do enough research to just get the draft done, but it's be okay with it. It's kind of like what we talked about with ones, like be okay with it being a first draft. But in the case of fives, like it's not going to be the right amount of research. Like it will not be enough, but that's okay. Cause it's a first draft and like you may even cut this part and then you don't need to do all that research on like how people ate in China in the 1700s or whatever.
Right.
Like you can do that later, because I've, a couple times people come to me, they're like, I've been researching for 5 years. Like I need to start writing. I'm like, yes, you need to start writing. Like you didn't need to research for 5 years. Probably, maybe, but maybe you didn't need to do that quite that much to just start. So yeah, that idea of like minimum viable research can be helpful.
This is that we could almost just stop right there. Cause I have a friend of mine who is an Enneagram 5 and was writing a book, and literally it was years. And this person used Evernote. I don't know if anyone here ever uses Evernote anymore, but it was like, he had like 300,000 documents inside of there as research for this book. And I'm like, I would just be so overwhelmed with all the stuff that I knew. And eventually he had to hire a ghostwriter because he just, you know, it was taking too long and too many years. And now there was too many ideas. So I love that idea of minimal. And this is true like in business too. Like you can research, but eventually you got to go get an LLC and just start selling or, you know, whatever it might be.
And just the idea of separating research and writing, you could see, you can do that with anything.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
So you know what I've done on this book? It's on a I don't want to go into what it's about, but I limited myself to 7 books that I would read.
Mm.
And then, so now we're almost done with the first draft, but I only referenced 7 different books that I thought were germane to the topic. And then, now I know of 200 other books that I could do, but now that the first draft is done, I'm going to send it to the editor. They're going to do a light edit, right? And put their, put their questions in the, their queries in the margin, blah, blah, blah. And then I'm going to go back to all that other stuff. And go, okay, well, now I think I'll go check over here because this might be an interesting thing. But I just had to get that first draft done. So, you know, I was worried that if I had too many books, I'd get buried, you know?
Yeah, that's such a good idea. Just putting a cap on it. Yeah. It's going to be these 7, and I'm going to say that's enough.
Yeah, and then I'm going to go back and look at some other stuff once the draft is done. And I may replace things or whatever, but I just need to get the structure up and going. And this is true of starting businesses or whatever it is in your life. If you're not an artist, but anything creative, right? Like at some point, man, you got to get out of research mode and get into writing. Do you have a mantra for 5s?
Let me see. I think it literally is. Yep. Minimum viable research. That's the mantra.
Oh, that's a good one. All right. 6s. Let's talk about the loyalists. What's your experience like with them in helping them in a creative process?
So interestingly, I'm really close friends with a few 6s, but I haven't worked with many 6s. I have no idea why it's turned out that way. Hmm. So I'm like, I feel like this is one number where I'm one type where I'm like, I don't know really how this manifests creatively that I've observed. I mean, the mantra I have down from just knowing a couple of 6s is that like it's just a book. Like, so if there's catastrophizing, like, well, what if this happens? What if this happens? You know, it's like, let's like lower the stakes, like lower the vibration so it doesn't feel as scary in a way. Kind of similar to the 4, where it's like not let like trying to prevent a kind of spiraling out and thinking of the worst that could happen.
So,
but, yeah,
I think well, first of all, I would like to know how many different forms of backup they have for their manuscripts. You know, it's probably like,
right. Several hard drives,
backing up that manual, emailing it to themselves, texting it to themselves at the end of every day. I mean, I get it, but if I imagine for 6s, that would be kind of funny. I think with 6s, probably one of the things that they really struggle with is, self-doubt, self-questioning, too much self-questioning and worry that they don't have, not trusting themselves,
similar to four.
Yeah, but for very different reasons. I mean, I think 4s tend to vacillate between grandiosity and undervaluing themselves all the time. Like I'm either William Faulkner or I can't even put 2 sentences together. It's one or the other, you know, all the time. I don't think 6s are too earthy for that. You know, they're too practical, too earthy. But I think for 6s, anxiety just, and you know what the other thing about anxiety is I don't know if you have this experience, Mary, but sometimes I can read a book, a manuscript, and I think to myself, this writing sounds anxious. Like this, you're looking like, right?
Yes, totally.
It feels very constricted. And so I just, you know, the message to me with, you know, 6s when I used to do therapy was, you know, hey, you have to learn how to trust yourself and just trust the process. Trust yourself. You have it in you. Just put it down. Don't get too anxious. Don't worry. It's going to get, you know, it's like just.
Yeah.
you know. And there's been some great six authors. I'm just looking up here.
Yeah.
Probable sixes on this list were like Mark Twain, Sigmund Freud. That's interesting. William James, Tolkien, Krishnamurti, John Grisham. I mean, you know, that's according to this list, you know.
Well, I was just thinking, similar to how with three, we said like, oh, imagine like what if people read this, but you were never associated with it. I wonder if for six, it could be an interesting exercise to try to channel someone who does have confidence.
Mm.
Like my friend was saying, someone once told her, a witch actually, she would see a witch. And the witch told her to, like, in a challenging situation where she didn't know how to act, think of someone she really admired.
Yes.
And how they would act and channel that person in that moment.
Mm.
And it's kind of like that. It's like, what if you were, you know, Mark Twain? How would Mark Twain write this scene? But him.
Yeah. So it's interesting because we all have people who are, we have writers that we admire who are looking over our shoulder when we're writing.
You know?
And periodically I'll look back at one, I'll go, how would you say that? Because I'm not quite sure, but I really, and that's not plagiarism, and it's not,
no,
it's just kind of like consulting with your friends from the library, you know, it's like, well, how would you have said that, you know?
Yeah.
By the way, I think some of the sixes, you know, if I was going to get, I mean, as far as humorists go, like Mark Twain, mm-hmm. let's say, but, and I don't know if this is true, maybe David Sedaris, when they have that when their anxiety makes them so funny.
Like Woody Allen, maybe is a six. I don't know. Like the neuroses. I don't know.
How about Nora Ephron?
Totally.
You know, and it can feel seven-ish and sometimes, but it's really like this kind of, it's like self-doubt creeps in and it's just, there's a book I'm reading right now, a memoir called Misfit. Have you read this by Gulman? He's a comedian. Well, anyway, it's quite funny. But it begins with him talking about 2 years of a hellacious depression and then going back into his childhood and just growing up in like, it's just in Boston, you know, in sort of a poor family. And it's quite funny and it's very six.
Yeah.
So it's really, really, really fun to listen to it. Which is, I don't normally listen to books, but this one is one of those you should listen because he's a stand-up guy. So it's kind of, all right, you know, moving on. Let's talk about seven.
A little side note before you go to seven. One of the funny things about when we have people on, Mary, because we obviously have a lot of authors, is as mm-hmm. we start talking about the Enneagram, a lot of times they'll have an aha moment. Oh my gosh, I totally wrote this book from my type perspective. And they've mm-hmm. never thought about it before.
Cool.
And they see it.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Or the titles of their books.
Yeah,
like they never made a connection between the title of their book and their type.
Titles.
And you're like, oh. Yeah, oh my gosh. my gosh.
They realized what they were doing is pretty interesting.
Oh my word.
So fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who was the seven that we had on now that we're going into sevens? It was Annie Downs. Didn't she write a book like This Is Fun?
Oh, yeah,
what was the name of that book?
Yeah, it's like
This Is Fun.
Look that up, Anthony, because that's
fun
just
or,
yeah. And I'm like, and you're a seven, and it was like, oh, you know.
Are we having
and
fun? Like,
your book
yet?
Is called like
yeah. That's it. Are we having
yes,
fun
that
yet?
That one. Oh, are we having fun yet? Yeah. Oh my god, it's like the mantra of the seven.
Yeah. Oh my that's gosh, so
chasing
oh.
fun.
That's chasing
a, that's
fun.
Else. Yeah, there's a couple.
Oh books. My gosh, it's like really, and you didn't know great. You didn't make that connection. All right, let's talk about seven. Have you worked with sevens before?
I have, yes. I think so. With sevens, one thing I've encouraged them to do is just like they can lean into doing a few projects at one time. Because sometimes there's, you know, sometimes they'll talk about with seven, like the shiny object syndrome, where they're like, oh, but I got bored with this one. I want to move on to the next one. And instead of fighting that, I think it can be like, okay, just do both at the same time. So the writer Lauren Groff, for example, I don't know if she's a seven, but I do know that she has several projects going on at a time. And she like puts them in different parts of her office. So she'll like in this chair, she works on a novel that she's writing. Over in that chair, she's writing the short story over. And she just kind of moves around and hops around. And like, I don't work like that. I don't think, you know, the reason I don't, you know, seven, like I would, that would make me crazy. But if a seven feels confined by a long-term creative project, this could be a solution. You don't need to be. You can do multiple things at once because there are people who do that.
Oh, man. Do you have a mantra for them?
Well, the mantra I put is I can always pivot. So like you're not like you can always abandon it. You don't have to abandon it today, but you can abandon it later.
Right.
You still want to.
Yep. I had a friend of mine, he used to say about, he's in this 12-step program I'm in, and he used to tell the group, you know, the only reason I stayed is because you told me I could leave.
Wow. That's good.
So, in fact, I think I need to write that down. That needs to go into a book. But that's true, right? It's like, you know, the reason you stay working is you told me I didn't have to. Like, you know, that can really work.
You can always quit tomorrow.
You can always quit tomorrow. All right, eights.
Eights. So my husband is an eight, like I mentioned, and I asked him if he were writing a book. Once I asked him, like, if he were writing a book, what would he most struggle with? And he said, I would just hire someone else to write the book for
him. Well, that's decisive. We appreciate that about eights. They're decisive.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, the eights I've worked with has been the number I will say that probably least has struggled to finish. It's like once they start, they're like, this will get done. They do very much appreciate practical advice around writing a strong draft and doing so efficiently, I have found. I mean, I think with eights, it's kind of find a structure that works for you and then lean into it because, you know, structure is good. I mean, you know, being married to an eight, I will say, I think one thing to you had said earlier that you can imagine twos could really tap into the heart of a thing. We haven't really talked more, except for that, more kind of substantively about the kinds of things people write, but I can see eights struggling with like identifying with the heart in the work, like the vulnerable part, because that's vulnerable. So that might be a good challenge for eights for themselves. To be willing to actually feel vulnerable when they're writing.
Yeah.
Not the whole time, but like in moments.
Yeah, just to get
But you know, sometimes authors, they feel safe in the context of a character. If they're writing fiction, they can really explore it safely if it's not to them, right? Like, you know. So I'm going to go through this in a minute, and if we have a chance at the end, maybe we can sort of talk about different types, maybe examples of different types as writers. But let's talk about nines, because they are really good writers a lot of the time.
Yeah, and like my friend is a poet. She's an incredible poet. She's a nine. I have found, and it was interesting to hear you say this earlier. I think you related, maybe when we were talking about fours and the self-doubt, but the nines I've worked with have struggled with self-confidence. So, the mantra I've written down is, I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I don't know. I think that nines are so lovely to work with. But they can struggle to get it done. And it seems to be confidence that comes up a lot.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's right. Also, though, it's focus. A little bit like, for different reasons, sevens, nines can get into something, and then they have mission drift. Sevens get distracted. Mm. I mean, sevens and nines, both when they're kids, tend to get, like, if they have problems in school, they get the ADHD thing. It's not just sevens, it's nines. They're easily distracted. And so if something else presents itself, they get off task and they go after that. You know, but they have that ability to see the world through so many different lenses is so helpful as a writer. Like it's just natural to them, you know, especially as storytellers. So they are.
Are they highly empathetic also? Nines are highly empathetic. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like such a great skill.
Yes.
In the writing realm.
Yes. I mean, they can be fantastic. I have such a love for nines. I've been married for almost 40 years to a nine, and every year I sort of fall more in love with nines because of it. Because they have such, as long as they do their work, it's like every type, right? If they get stuck in a rut, that's no good. But so, so great. By the way, I think, so let's just kind of go through a couple. I'm going to guess some types. This is complete speculation, but whatever. I bet you J.K. Rowling is a nine.
Really?
Yeah, just based on what I've read about her. Well, they have this kind of creativity, this ability to see other worlds. Like nines are super imaginative.
Yeah.
Like they can get really imaginative. I've said this a million times on the show. Anthony might agree or disagree, but I mean, all the best songwriters I know, so many of them are nines, man. They're great storytellers.
Mm.
Really, really good storytellers. By the way, for eights, I think Hemingway was an eight. So, you know, again, I think Toni Morrison was probably an eight. So you just
highly emotional work,
highly emotional, but really like intense. A lot of intensity in that writing. By the way, Anthony, remind me to tell you a complete editorial blurb here. But speaking of Hemingway, I went to a bullfight. I will never do that again, just so you know. Oh, please. A whole other episode. All right. So I think I think sevens, think about Tom Wolfe. Certainly you think about Oscar Wilde. Sounds pretty seven to me, I guess.
Yeah.
We said about sixes, maybe Mark Twain. I think.
Well, and I thought, did you say John Grisham was a six?
Yeah.
I think you did. And I feel like it tracks for a six to be a thriller writer.
Maybe.
Right?
Maybe.
In a way.
Yeah.
Because it's like that. I mean, thrillers are driven, they're anxiety driven.
Right. Yeah. I think for fives, do you think Joan Didion might be a five with a four?
Oh, wow.
Maybe. But certainly when you think about maybe Emily Dickinson, maybe. Certainly Sartre. Definitely had a five thing going on.
Simone de Beauvoir, maybe also.
Yeah, I mean that very analytical and sometimes nihilistic kind of, you know, they can kind of go to that space. I think fours, if we don't say J.D. Salinger, we're all crazy. J.D. Salinger, Catcher in the Rye is the quintessential four book. I don't even think we need to go on, but we could mention Virginia Woolf. We could mention Anne Rice, Dostoevsky, Faulkner. Mm. These are all fours. Tons of them never end well, but whatever. What do you think for threes? You had a three author in mind? I got one, but you tell me yours. You tell. Okay.
No.
I bet you Truman Capote.
Oh, yes. I agree. That's good. That's a good one.
Yeah. I think Truman Capote definitely has that three quality. And a genius writer when he wrote. Unfortunately, he was a little sidetracked.
Had the ambition.
Yeah. He had lots of ambition, very concerned about image and that sort of thing.
Wonder what Harper Lee, what would Harper Lee be?
I don't know. But, you know, basically she wrote one book, basically.
What? Right. And really struggled to write more.
Yeah. I mean, To Kill a Mockingbird is a pretty good place to stop, but I'm just saying she probably had, and it took her years to write that book.
Right.
I mean, Robert Farrar had to spend like 4 or 5 years getting that book out of her.
Whatever it was tortured.
Yeah, but I think when she was done with it, the impression I got is the rest of her life, she was just very happy being the person who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird.
Mm.
So that's actually maybe nine-ish. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe
Hard to know. I have no idea. I cannot give you a two. Can't think of one off the top of my head. But maybe on the next show, I'll come up. I'll think this week.
I'm going to be thinking about this all weekend.
Yeah, right now I'm kind of winging it. But how about for ones, C.S. Lewis maybe?
Oh, that's nice.
Maybe. Let me see. Henry David Thoreau. Maybe. Oh, I know. T.S. Eliot, maybe. Or a five. But the poet Eliot might have been a one. Could have been a five. But anyway, I just love kind of like
Harper Lee
this stuff
might
around.
Have been a one.
Maybe.
Like justice focused and like the conscientiousness of, you know, having only written one book. I also always loved Madeline L'Engle, so I wonder what she was.
Oh, no, that's so interesting because I knew people who knew her quite well. Yeah, she lived in New York City, and she went to this – a friend of mine went to All Angels Episcopal Church in New York, which is where she went. And they were on the little vestry together and stuff like that. She was a pretty outspoken person. My daughter is actually named after her.
Really?
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah, my daughter Madeline is named after her, and she loved Madeline L'Engle. In fact, she has a letter from Madeline L'Engle that's like in on her wall. She wrote as a little kid, she was like in fourth grade, she sent Madeline L'Engle a letter saying how much she loved her, and like 2 years later the response came, handwritten note. It's just she probably got so many letters from kids that she finally got around to Maddie's 2 years later. And it was like the biggest day in our house.
That is so special.
It was really quite dear. So, all right, this was great. Anthony, this was great.
Yeah.
We've been talking
our
new friend, Mary Adkins, writing coach, founder of the book Incubator. Mary, everyone needs to go to your website. Anyone interested in writing it, who wants to get a... be a part of a 12-month program where they learn to write, revise, and pitch a novel or a memoir either to an agent or to a publishing house, or just wants to write one. Maybe they don't want to pitch it to anybody. But what a journey. You sound like such a great coach, and knowing the Enneagram makes you even better, I am sure of it. We could have said so much more about the creative process for each of these types. People can learn about it, this by going where?
They can go to thebookincubator.com to learn about the Book Incubator. And I also have a podcast where I just give writing tips called The First Draft Club.
So oh, I love that.
If they want to listen to a writing podcast, they can just go check that out, The First
Draft Club. Oh, yeah. I love that. And then, of course, your website, Mary Adkins. And by the way, folks, it's not A-T. It's A-D as in dog, AdkinsWriter.com, and at Adkins Mary for Instagram, et cetera. So Mary, man, I love this. I love this. I hope our folks will love it. A tenth of how much I've loved it. Anthony?
Yes.
You know I love you, right?
You brother. It's good to be with you. Good to have you on, Mary.
Yeah, indeed.
It was so fun. Thank you both. I loved it too.
Hey, everybody. Remember these words, would you? May you have love. May you have joy. May you have peace. May you have healing. And may you have rest in this new year and every year to come. We'll talk to you next time.